Around the Triangle. I'm Sybil McGuire, and we're speaking today with David Wessel, and we're talking about his book, In Fed We Trust, Ben Bernanke's War on the Great Panic, How the Federal Reserve Became the Fourth Branch of Government. Now, David's been the Wall Street Journal's insider at the Federal Reserve, the ultimate protector of the financial system on which the entire economy relies. And I am so glad that we get to speak to you today about this, because if anyone can make sense of this, it would be you, or maybe Ben. Thanks for joining us this morning, David.
It's a pleasure.
Give us a little bit of a background. The current financial crisis began in late 2007, correct?
That's correct.
It's been called the Great Panic, but you say that it's been much bigger in price tag, geographic scale, and duration than lesser recessions that have occurred in the late 20th century.
Well, right. I mean, we went through a very strong period in our economy where, in the 2000s, where the economy did reasonably well. A lot of people saw their incomes go up, and we borrowed a ton of money, hoping that times would remain good forever. Turned out they didn't. We had a big crash, and it turned out to be a much more severe shock to our economy than most people thought would ever happen again. And the result was a recession that is deeper and longer than any we've seen since the Great Depression. And 3 years after it began, we find ourselves with an economy which is, to be sure, growing, but growing at a very slow rate compared to how far down it went. And we have 9.5% unemployment and no prospect of a quick return to full employment. Today, we have more people who've been out of work for a year or more than there are people who live in the city of Los Angeles, our second largest city. Of all the American homeowners with mortgages, 1 in 4 owes more money than the house is worth. So we're really in, we're not in another Great Depression, thank God, but we are in something that looks a little bit like a great stagnation, and that's disturbing and painful to a lot of Americans.
Where the U.S. economy stands on the third anniversary of the start of the crisis, oh my goodness, we're climbing out. But what can we expect as we move into the fourth anniversary of this crisis?
Well, what's most likely to happen is the economy will chug along, but it won't grow very fast, and that means unemployment will come down very slowly. Private employers are adding something less than 100,000 jobs a month. State and local governments are cutting their payrolls. So it's going to be a long time before the 8 million people who lost jobs during the recession get their jobs back. I think that the fear is that when you're growing so slowly, something bad happens. It could push you back into recession. It might be, I don't know, a war in the Middle East that would send oil prices up, or we discover that another big financial firm is rotten at the core, or we have a repeat of the problems that we saw in Europe a few months ago, or China turns out to mismanage its economy. Any number of things could go wrong, and if that happens, if you're growing slowly, you could go back into recession. So the scary thing is the best case is very slow growth. It makes you worry about what the worst case could be.
Tell us a little bit about how the actions the Fed took in response challenged not only the ideology of capitalism, but the essence of democracy.
Well, look, the ideology of capitalism is that markets are the best way to organize economic activity, and the way to make sure that people in markets make good decisions is that if they make a bad decision, the pain goes to them.
Mm-hmm.
And in this crisis, our leaders decided that they couldn't afford to let the pain go to the people who made mistakes, because that would have turned the whole economy inside out. So we have seen a much bigger role for the government than we saw before, and as a result of the crisis, we're going to see a lot more government regulation than we had before the crisis. I think that's the biggest change, that we have decided, because we had this calamity, that we can't trust the markets quite as much as we thought, and we're going to see more regulation, more oversight of banks, tougher rules that prevent them from taking some of the risks that turned out to be so devastatingly wrong.
Now, was it because a lot of regulations had been repealed that allowed some of this to go on?
I don't actually think it. I know that's a popular view. I don't actually think that's the case.
I
think what happened is that the markets evolved, and we had whole new ways of doing business on Wall Street. Institutions that previously had not been big players became big players, and the financial regulatory system was stuck in a kind of 1930s mode. So, for instance, AIG, the big insurance company, was allowed to build this essentially a casino on the side of derivatives, and they didn't have enough money to pay off the bets when the people who placed the bets came to them and said, okay, I won, you lost, give me the money. And they said, well, we don't have the money. Well, that happened because they kind of exploited a vulnerability in our regulatory system, which had been created to monitor banks. It never occurred to the architects of the system that some insurance company would be doing this. Well, you can repeat that dozens of times. Maybe none of them is quite as spectacular as AIG, and you can see that we just had a system where they spent all their time worrying about a few banks, and other people were causing great problems.
Should these institutions have been allowed to fail?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, in ordinary times, the answer would be yes. The problem is that if you are in extraordinary times when everybody seems to be in trouble, it's hard for me to imagine that the government could have let Bear Stearns fail, Citibank fail, Lehman Brothers fail, Merrill Lynch fail, Morgan Stanley fail, Goldman Sachs fail. That's like having all the redwoods in the forest fall over at the same time, and mm-hmm. little people will get hurt. So, but I think the concern is that by rescuing Bear Stearns in March 2008, they created some new expectations that if you get in trouble, the government will bail you out. And that led people to take unwise risks, and they didn't do enough to correct for that. And I think some of the people in the government saw letting Lehman fail as a way to do that. It turned out to be a miscalculation. So, and one of the ironies here is if part of the problem was, and it was, that we had banks that were too big to fail, that is, when they went under, the government had to bail them out for the good of the system, well, we find ourselves 3 years later with fewer, bigger banks. That doesn't seem like a very good outcome, and it's one that really wasn't addressed in the law that Congress has just passed.
The book is In Fed We Trust, Ben Bernanke's War on the Great Panic. We're speaking with Pulitzer Prize winning author David Wessel. He's also the Wall Street Journal's insider at the Federal Reserve. And the book's been out for a while. This is the paperback version with an epilogue on how the U.S. economy and Ben Bernanke fared in 2010. And what do you think the Bernanke Fed got right and what it got wrong?
Well, I think they were wrong to let this happen in the first place. They were wrong after Bear Stearns to not prepare better for the collapse of other financial institutions, so they were caught off guard in September mm-hmm. 2008. But I think they got right the notion that this was a really big deal that called for extraordinary action by the Fed, things that the Fed really had never done before. They cut interest rates to zero. They realized that wasn't enough, so they printed $1.5 trillion worth of money electronically and bought securities in an attempt to keep the economy rolling. And I think, so on that sense, they got the big one right. They didn't sit there paralyzed by fear or ignorance and said, what should we do? They were willing to experiment, to do things by trial and error, some of which worked and some of which didn't, but enough of them worked so that even though we have an awful economy now, we have one that's growing and the private sector is hiring a little bit, which is better than the alternative, as painful as that seems.
What about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac?
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are really a disaster. And this is one, as I said, a lot of things caught people by surprise. No one should have been surprised by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. There had been people warning for years, including at the Wall Street Journal, that these things were an accident waiting to happen. And, of course, when you have all your money in the housing industry and the house prices go down, you get hit hard. And Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac got hit hard. And they will probably end up being the most expensive part of the bailout. The most expensive part won't be a bank or AIG or General Motors. It'll be Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. We spent $145 billion so far to fill the hole there. We're spending $1 billion every week of taxpayer money at Fannie and Freddie. And a couple of economists, Mark Zandi and Alan Blinder, who did a big analysis of the stimulus and the bailouts, predicted that in the end it'll be $300 billion down the drain at Fannie and Freddie in order to set them right. The government basically took over the mortgage market because of the crisis, and it hasn't found an exit strategy yet, and that's a big problem.
And people are still really underwater and losing their homes, and we have a glut of houses.
Right. We're going to go through a period where it'll take a long time before housing gets back to normal. We built too many houses and we oversold the notion of home ownership as a necessary condition for joining the middle class, and now we're paying the price for that. Some people will do okay because they'll be able to buy houses cheap. You know, houses are cheaper now. Mortgage rates are very low. People who own houses who can refinance can save a lot of money. But people who have a house that's not worth what the mortgage is can't refinance. And if they want to move to get a new job, they can't sell it without taking a big hit. And so we're through, going to go through a big period of pain in housing. And I don't think anything can happen that would change that. What we can hope will happen is the rest of the economy will gain momentum and pick up speed so people can afford to make their mortgage payments and we can compensate for a lousy housing market. But for now, it's a huge problem for banks, for homeowners, and, of course, for people who work in construction who really are relying on federal government programs for most of their work now.
And I do know people that are a little bit underwater on their mortgages who are just furious that there are so many people walking away from their homes.
Yeah, that's really an interesting thing. I mean, I think that one of the social changes that we'll see here is that the stigma for walking away from your mortgage has disappeared, with so many people doing it, and in some cases being better off. Instead of paying the loan that you can no longer afford, either because you overborrowed or because you lost your job, you give the keys to the bank and you go rent someplace that costs less, or you buy someplace that costs less than the monthly payments you were paying on your mortgage. Well, if we all do that, like, you know, if everybody walks away from their debts, you know, we won't have no one will make a mortgage, ever make a mortgage again. So it is a very serious problem. I can understand why people are doing it, because they are doing what's economically rational for them. But the side effects, if everybody does it, are pretty bad. And I think that's a problem we haven't quite come to grips with yet.
The book is In Fed We Trust, a New York Times notable book and New York Times bestseller. We're speaking with the author, David Wessel. It's just now out in paperback with an epilogue on how the U.S. economy and Ben Bernanke fared in 2010. And I like the comment that the honest slogan that could have been hung from a banner from the Fed's headquarters early in the spring of 2010 would have been, "It could have been worse."
Right. I stole that line, I confess, from Barney Frank, the Massachusetts Democrat who chairs the House Financial Services Committee and is the best source of laugh lines for financial reporters. And he once told a hearing of economists that he'd envied them because they could say, well, if we hadn't done this, it could have been worse. And he told them, that's great, may work for you, may get you tenure, but no politician ever got reelected with a bumper sticker that said, it would have been worse if not for me. And I think that's really why Ben Bernanke is so unpopular. It's not that he didn't save us from a Great Depression. It's that people think he bailed out Wall Street and didn't bail out Main Street. And you can understand why they think that, given how bad the economy still is 3 years after this began.
What was it like inside the Fed when it appeared that, we had tanked the entire world economy?
Well, I think it was pretty scary for them. They were really not equipped to deal with something of this magnitude. It's not a 24/7 operation. And there they were. I asked the general counsel of the New York Fed once, did you ever sleep in your office? And he smiled and opened his filing cabinet, and there was an air mattress that he had bought because he was spending so many nights in the office. At the Fed headquarters in Washington, they don't have a 24-hour cafeteria. They barely have vending machines. There's no McDonald's, 24-hour McDonald's near there. So at one point, the Fed PR person called her husband and asked him to pick up some takeout and bring it by. And after that, they got a refrigerator and made a deal with a local Subway to deliver sandwiches, keep the refrigerator stocked with sandwiches. So when they had those all nights, there'd be something there for people to eat. There was a very small set of people who were sitting there often around the coffee table in Ben Bernanke's office, talking into a speakerphone that connected other parts of Washington and New York, trying to figure out, what do we do now? How do you deal with this new crisis? Knowing that there wasn't any textbook and any guarantee that anything they did would actually work. So I think it was frightening and nerve-wracking. And I think most of them now look back on it and say the way a bunch of soldiers did after a battle. You know, we lost a few comrades, and we didn't do everything perfectly, but we saved the day. We captured the hill, we prevented the fort from being taken, and that's kind of the way they look at it now.
And it could have been worse.
It could definitely have been worse. People don't believe that, but it could have been.
Tell me what this has revealed about the largely unchecked power that this band of unelected central bankers holds.
Well, I think that we learned just how much power the Fed has. When Ben Bernanke took office, the Fed had $800 billion worth of loans and securities on its books. Today they have $2.3 trillion worth, money he created electronically without getting permission from Congress or the Treasury or the President or you or me, because that's the power they have. I don't think people understood that. I don't think people understood that when you have a financial panic, it's essentially up to the Fed to decide, does Bear Stearns live and Lehman Brothers die? And I think that one of the reasons the Fed gets so much criticism is that it kind of for generations cultivated this air of mystery and we're the high priests and we know more than you do. And then that kind of backfired on them because people didn't understand what they did. Now, some respects, the law that Congress passed has checked their power, and I think that's a good thing. In the future, if the Fed wants to make a loan like the one it did to Bear Stearns, it'll have to get the written okay of the Treasury Secretary, a kind of sign-off of the elected government, which didn't exist before. And I think that's a good thing because we are a democracy, and if it's really a crisis, the elected leadership should be involved in making the decisions.
And then held accountable for it because these people, unfortunately, aren't elected. And, well, while they're accountable, that's a touchy subject.
I think it's important to remember that there's a reason we have a central bank like this, that our elected leaders have decided that if we gave them the power to set interest rates, they would set them too low. We'd have more growth now and more inflation later. So they kind of voluntarily in 1913 tied their hands and said to the Federal Reserve, we'll protect you from political interference. You do the right thing on interest rates. But I don't think that when that happened that people were fully could ever have imagined that in 2008 they'd be using trillions of dollars to decide which banks live or die. And that moves into the area where I think it really is up to the elected government to decide how do we run our banking system. And so we're in the process of coming up with a new power-sharing arrangement, if you will, that allows us to rely on the ability of the Fed to create money and on the skills and wisdom of the enormous number of people who work there who actually know what they're doing, but to have the Treasury Secretary more involved, Tim Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, talks about this as civilian control of the military, that ultimately the elected leadership ought to be more involved in making these decisions. Just like we wouldn't let the generals go off and fight a war without the president being involved, we shouldn't let the Federal Reserve do the financial equivalent.
Without other branches of government being involved and informed.
Exactly.
Besides that lesson, what other lessons have we learned, and how vulnerable are we still to something like this?
We've learned that it's a mistake to tell everybody in America that they ought to buy a house if they want to be a middle-class person. Some people should rent, and there's nothing to be ashamed of by renting instead of owning. We've learned that whether you're a bank CEO or an ordinary consumer, if you borrow too much figuring that things will be better tomorrow and you'll be able to pay the loan off, that's as imprudent as it sounds, that you can't always rely on things being so good that you can pay off the loan, and that we sometimes you have to not borrow even if you'd like to spend. We've learned that you cannot trust banks and the markets to do the right thing. Markets are a great way to organize economic activity, the best way we know to allocate capital, but they need adult supervision, and they didn't have enough of it. And I think we've also learned that preventing crises is impossible. You have to build a system that's more resilient to them. We don't have a vaccine against financial crises, but we have to find a way to force the banks to have enough money individually so if one of them gets into trouble, it doesn't communicate the disease to the whole financial system before somebody can step in.
And then the entire world.
And and we've learned how interconnected things are. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the reasons the Lehman bankruptcy was so messy was that it spread across many countries, each of which had different rules. Mervyn King, Ben Bernanke's equivalent in England, has said that big banks are global in life but national in death, by which he means the bank gets big, it does great business overseas, it gets in trouble, and suddenly it's a British bank, so the British government is stuck paying the tab when they fail. Or the same with us, with Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers. And we're never going to have a global government, but we do have to have a more coherent way of where governments agree how they're going to regulate and set rules for big banks so we don't have this again. That's going on now. There's this committee of bank supervisors that meets in Basel, Switzerland, and they're trying to come up with new rules, and we'll see whether they work. But we pretty much know what doesn't work. The question is whether we can come up with a better way. We can agree on a better way of monitoring the banks.
On how things do work, yes. And do you think maybe we've learned now that what goes up must come down?
We've learned it, but we'll forget it.
Thank you.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
If we have another decade without this, memories will grow short and people will be doing foolish things again.
David, it's just been a pleasure talking with you. I know that you have another interview coming up. So reluctantly, I will let you go speak to them. It has been fascinating. I think maybe I understand it a little bit better now. And if you'd like to understand it, the book is In Fed We Trust, Ben Bernanke's War on the Great Panic. It's now out in paperback. We've been speaking with Pulitzer Prize winning Wall Street Journal writer David Wessel. For Around the Triangle, I'm Sybil McGuire.